following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Once you come to Jesus, all your problems are going to be over. Is that the understanding you had when you first said yes to God? Oh, better yet, has that been your experience since you trusted in Christ? I remember when I was a young believer, and I would hear these amazing testimonies, these very dramatic testimonies from these people who would talk about how they had hit bottom before they came to Christ, but the contrast they presented with the before and after was particularly striking. It was almost like somebody trying to describe the old Wizard of Oz film. You know, before Christ, their life was in dreary black and white. But then once they came to Christ, everything suddenly transformed into amazing technicolor. And can I be honest? There have been times I want to go back to some of those people and sue them for false advertising. My walk with the Lord has most definitely not always been upward and onward, as the path of some of those folks described. Maybe I should have been paying a little more attention to what Jesus himself said in Matthew chapter 7, verse 13, when he said that the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, whereas the way to eternal life is narrow and winding. As I've walked this road with Jesus, I've learned that sometimes he does lead us up the side of the mountain, but there are other times when he leads us down into the valleys. And sometimes the path is filled with beauty and brightness, but other times it is so clouded and dark that we have to cling more tightly to him just to keep from losing our way. And why is that so? Why doesn't God just immediately raise us up to glory when we put our faith in Jesus? You ever wondered that? Why does he sometimes require his children to struggle through adversity? Well, one big reason is that when we come to God, we all tend to bring a lot of baggage. There are some things we need to let go of and leave behind as we make the journey. There are also some lessons that we need to learn. And perhaps even some lessons we need to unlearn as we seek to allow God to mold us and shape us into the people he intends for us to be. And often the most effective way for God to teach us those lessons is to allow us to face the chisel of adversity, sometimes even a lot of adversity. Allowing God to mold us and shape us is not always a pleasant experience. But then again, I don't imagine that block of granite appreciates it very much when the sculptor takes that chisel to it either. Consider what the Bible tells us about the man who was destined to become Israel's greatest king, David. David was born 3,000 years ago on the backside of nowhere. He was the youngest son in a family that raised sheep for a living. And then suddenly David found himself plucked out of the pasture and placed in the palace. He was anointed by prophets. He defeated giants. He led armies to victory. He was befriended by princes. He married a princess. Life was looking up for young David until suddenly it wasn't. As we talked about last week, all of a sudden, through no fault of his own, David found himself stripped of every support he was leaning on, save his relationship to God. He found himself running for his life. And David continued to run for years until he finally sat on the throne of a united Israel. During those dark days, I imagine it was pretty tempting for David to look up to heaven and say, God, what are you doing? I mean, you promised me I was going to be a king. Why am I running around like an outlaw? And yet, it was during those scary and confusing times that God molded and shaped David into the person who could be a good king. Through those trials, God tested him, God trained him, and God triumphed through him along the way of making David into the person he could use. Today, we're going to take a quick run through 1 Samuel 21 through 23. We're not going to be able to read every verse, but I encourage you maybe this afternoon to spend some time in those chapters on your own, kind of putting the pieces together as we skip through them this morning, looking at some of the lessons David learned during that time when he was on the run. One lesson David learned was to trust in God's provision. in chapter 21, actually going back to chapter 20, when David ran from Saul's first attempts to kill him, he left home empty-handed. David hadn't prepared a go bag. He just jumped out and ran. And he sought help in an unlikely place. In verse 21, we read, "Then David came to Nob, to Abimelech the priest. And Abimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?'" Nob was a village located near the city of Jerusalem. It was a settlement made up primarily of priests and their families. We're not told this explicitly, but the text suggests that the tabernacle, the tent that Moses had made, which represented God's presence with his people, was located at this time in Nob. It had apparently been moved there from Shiloh years before when the Philistines had attacked that city. Now, as a settlement of priests, Nob would have been the most unlikely place to find two things. One, weapons, and two, food. Because most of the food that came into this town would have been given through consecrated offerings that were intended for the priests and their families. Lay people were not normally allowed to participate in those things. But David comes into this town, and his unusual arrival raises a suspicion of the lead priest, Ahimelech. And we read in verse 1, Ahimelech came trembling. Why was he trembling? Well, he was trembling because he knew David's reputation as a fierce warrior. He also was a little puzzled that here's one of the king's top generals, and he's showing up with no bodyguards, no troops, just him, not even carrying a bag. That is suspicious. And David convinced Ahimelech to help by feeding him a cover story about being on a secret mission of the king. Verse 2, David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter of which I'm sending you, which I've commissioned you, and I've directed the young men to a certain place.'" Now, right about there, somebody was saying, "Now, wait a minute. Whoa. This is supposed to be the man after God's own heart. This is supposed to be this great spiritual person here. Did he just lie to the high priest? What's going on here?" Well, some people try to excuse David's words by saying, well, he's just engaged in some very clever wordplay. Notice here, when he says he's on a mission from the king, he never mentioned King Saul, right? He never mentioned Saul's name. So some people say, well, yeah, he was on a mission from the king. Who was Israel's true king, ultimately? God was. So he's just, you know, he's just not giving details and letting Ahimelech fill in the blanks. And if he gets them wrong, that's on him, right? But David also went on to say, "I've arranged to meet the young men to rendezvous for this mission." Now, that's not true. Here's the thing. In any case, whether he was justified or not in this, David's decision to deceive Ahimelech might have brought him some short-term advantages, but it would have some disastrous consequences later. We're going to see that work out. So just keep that in mind. Okay? And right in the middle of David's conversation with Ahimelech, the chronicler gives us a little foreshadowing. He lets us know they weren't alone. There was a third party witnessing all this. Look at verse 7. "Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds." Doeg was a mercenary from Edom. He wasn't from Israel. And we don't know why he was detained at the tabernacle. There are, according to the law of Moses, a lot of reasons. Maybe he was there because he needed to be ceremonially cleansed after being exposed to something that would render him unclean, like a dead body. Or it could have been he was there to be inspected by a priest because he had been diagnosed with some kind of infectious skin disease, and that part of the priest's job was to declare that a person had been healed. But we don't know why he was there. But Doeg's presence foreshadows some really bad news for David, just to give you a little hint, okay? A little foreshadowing here. Doeg is identified as a servant of who? Saul. He's one of Saul's men. He's also called Saul's chief shepherd, although a lot of scholars believe he's more like a bodyguard. The point is, he is used to doing dirty work for King Saul. And that's going to come into play very shortly. So he is overhearing this conversation between David and Ahimelech. And David asked Ahimelech for help in two areas. He asked him, first of all, "Hey, do you have some food?" Verse 3, "What have you got? I'll take anything." And Ahimelech responds by giving David some old loaves of consecrated bread from the tabernacle. Each day, 12 fresh loaves of bread were placed on a special table within the tabernacle. And then every so often, those would be rotated out. And the old loaves were supposed to be distributed among the priests. Because remember, these are consecrated pieces of bread. They are special. They've been set apart for God's use. So after they come out, they're supposed to be given to people who have been purified and consecrated for the Lord's service. But as a special act of compassion, Ahimelech says, hey, all I got is this old bread, but if you can assure me that you and your men are ceremonially clean, I'll let you have some of it. And so David says, hey, we always consecrate ourselves before we go on these special missions. Sure, give me some bread. The other thing David asked for is a weapon. Verse 8, David said to Ahimelech, now, is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me because the king's matter was urgent. In this case, Ahimelech was able to offer David something very special. The very sword that David had taken from Goliath years before when he killed Goliath the Philistine. Ahimelech says, hey, if you go look behind the ephod, you're going to find Goliath's sword. It's all I got. Well, David says, I'll take it. That is a good sword. I don't know. It was being kept in the tabernacle as a trophy. And David says, hey, give it to me. I'll take it. Here's the thing. When we dedicate ourselves to following the Lord's plan, we can trust Him to provide the resources we need to fulfill His purpose. May not grant you everything you want, but He will give you what you need in order to do what He's called you to do. But we have to trust Him for that. The next lesson David learned while on the run. David learned to trust not only in God's provision, but in God's protection. In verse 10, David decided to go one place he was sure that Saul would not be able to follow him. Verse 10, then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Gath belongs to the Philistines, Israel's hated arch rivals at this time. Gath was located just across the border in Philistine territory, generally in the area that today we call the Gaza Strip. You see how all this kind of fits together. So he goes to Gaza. He walks in, goes into Gath. He walks in carrying Goliath's sword. Now remind me, where was Goliath from? And he thought this was going to work out. You know, David apparently was going to offer his services as a mercenary to Achish. But when he walks in, some of Achish's men look around. They recognize the sword. They recognize David. And say, hey, isn't this the guy that killed Goliath? Isn't this the guy that fights all Saul's battles for him? Isn't this the one they're writing songs about? And so David got a little nervous. David feared these words to heart and greatly feared, or took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So maybe this plan is not working out so well. So David did the only thing he could think of in a hurry. Verse 13, so he disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down into his beard. So he starts acting like some crazy guy. Hey, credit him for quick thinking here. Now, in those days, there was a very great stigma about mental illness. They would rather run him off than take a chance on killing him or having something happen to them. So Achish says, get this guy out of here. I got enough crazy people running around. I don't need one more. So David slips out of there and is able to head off into the wilderness. Now, later, David would write a psalm thanking God for allowing him to escape the situation. Psalm 34 actually includes an inscription that references this episode. And in that psalm, David writes this in Psalm 34, verse 4. I sought the Lord, and He answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Verses 7 and 8. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear Him and rescues them. David could write that because he'd experienced it. He says, taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in Him. David speaking the voice of experience there. If we're pursuing God's purpose, we can rest in His protection. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but we can rest in the assurance that God has this in the palm of His hand. Another lesson David learned. David learned how to lead other people. We get to chapter 22. After David escaped the Philistines, he hid out in a cave located about 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem. So he comes back into Israelite territory, specifically what was assigned to the tribe of Judah. In verse 22, verse 1, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So now he's been living in the palace, now he's living in a cave. Not long after David arrives, the word gets around that he's shown up, and other people start to drift in and say, "Hey, can we hang with you?" We read in verse 2, the latter part of verse 1, "And when his brothers and all his family heard of it, they went down there to him." So David's family seeks him out, coming from Bethlehem, which is not too far away. And they're hiding out with him because they fear Saul's going to go after them because of David. But that's not the only people that came seeking David out. In verse 3, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented, gathered to him. So all these people who are being oppressed in the land of Israel say, "David, you're our man. Saul's not been too good to us. We're going to come fight for you." And before long, David had a sizable armed force. We're told he became the captain over them. And he had, starting out, about 400 of these discontented rebel ragtag people that gathered around him. And pretty soon, it grew to 600 people that had gathered to follow David's leadership. And David first led these men to sneak all the way across the territory of Judah, right under Saul's nose, to the country next door, Moab. And there he arranged for his parents to stay while he's on the run from Saul, so they'd be protected from Saul. And then he leads his men back into Judah's territory to this large forest. In verse 5, the forest of Hereth. Now, these men, these initially 400, later 600 men that gathered around David there in the wilderness, I think about it, it's kind of like Robin Hood's Merry Men in Sherwood Forest. But they would become the core of David's fighting force for the rest of his career. These men would follow him anywhere. Some of them would go on to be part of what was called David's Mighty Men when he became king. That was like his elite special forces. And David's time leading this group of misfits sharpened his skills and grew his capacity as a leader. Listen, wherever God places you at the moment, serve him faithfully there. And seek to learn the lessons he's trying to teach you. Sometimes God may lead us into detours. Sometimes he may surround us with a bunch of misfits. But God places us in places in our lives for a reason, for a period of time. And I think about the parable Jesus told about the talents in Luke chapter 16. And do you remember what he said about the talents we're entrusted with? Be faithful in the small things. And when we show we're faithful in the small things, that prepares us to be rulers over much. So be faithful in the small things, wherever God's placed you. And if you serve faithfully, the time will come when God will open up greater opportunities for you to serve. Fourth, David learned choices have consequences. Now in this paragraph, verses 6 through 9 in chapter 22, we see Saul holding court in Gibeah, his capital, his headquarters, and he's chewing out his inner circle because none of them have managed to capture David. Then Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree at the height, with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing around him. And Saul said to the servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjamites." So these are his handpicked men, members of his family, his tribe. "Hear now, O Benjamite, will the son of Jesse also give you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds?" He's saying to these guys, "Listen, I'm your gravy train. You think David's going to give you all these jobs and all these perks?" Verse 8, "Now all of you have conspired against me. So there's no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse." In other words, he says, this is his posse. These are the guys he's put in power to help support his reign. And he says, "Y'all are all conspiring with the enemy." And then Doeg speaks out. And he says, "Hey, I know where David's been. I saw him hanging out with the priest. I saw the priest giving him guidance." And so what does Saul do? Verse 11. He orders Ahimelech and his company of priests to be brought before him. And then Saul accuses Ahimelech of conspiring with David to overthrow him. Verse 12, Saul said, "Listen here, son of Ahitub." Now notice that Saul doesn't respect Ahimelech enough to use his name. He calls him by his last name. Is it kind of like this? Nathan, if I come to you and say, "Hey, Nathan, I need to talk to you." Is that different when I say, "Hey, foreman"? Very different. Yes. So he's chewing this priest out. And he's accusing him of conspiring with his enemies. And Ahimelech tries to defend himself. He says in verses 14 and 15, basically said, "Hey, whoa, king, I don't know anything about any conspiracy. I mean, we're talking about David, right? Isn't David your son-in-law? Isn't David one of your chief generals? I haven't done anything for David that I haven't done for him for years." And despite Ahimelech's protest, Saul ordered that Ahimelech, his household, and the rest of the priests be executed. Verse 16, the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." And the king said to the guards who were attending him, "Turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death." Let that sentence sink in a minute. Here's the king of Israel saying to his guards, "Put the priest of the Lord to death." That doesn't sound like a fight I'd want to be on the wrong side of. And neither did the guards. Here's the king's bodyguards looking at each other saying, "Has the boss lost it?" And they refused to kill these priests. But there was somebody on hand who was more than willing to take up the job. Verse 18, the king said to Doeg, who remember is not an Israelite, he's an Edomite, he's a mercenary, he's working for hire, "You turn around and attack the priest." And Doeg the Edomite turned around, attacked the priest, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. That is a reference to the priestly uniform. And not only that, he struck Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of the sword. Both men and women, children and infants, oxen, donkeys, and sheep. He wiped out everything in Nob. He slaughtered them. Kind of ironic when you remember one of the reasons Saul lost his kingdom is because he refused to follow the Lord's instructions to wipe out one of Israel's enemies. And yet here he is wiping out Israel's priests. Only one man escaped the slaughter, Ahimelech's son, Abiathar. And Abiathar escaped and made his way to David with the news of the situation. And in verse 22, listen to what happens here. Then David said to Abiathar, "I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul." David's saying, "I knew this was going to happen." But then he goes on to say, "I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household." Who did David blame for the slaughter at Nob? Himself. Because he had tricked Ahimelech into helping him, Ahimelech and everyone connected to him paid with their lives. And David never forgot that. We know David learned this lesson for two reasons. One, he wrote Psalm 52 in response to this slaughter. I encourage you to go read that psalm in the near future and think about this. But when a similar situation arose later, which we're going to see here in just a minute, David intentionally chose to put himself at risk rather than expose an entire community to reprisals by Saul. Remember this, in whatever situation God has placed you in, your words and your actions do not just affect you. Okay? Choices have consequences. So act responsibly in order to minimize the impact on innocent bystanders. Be conscious of how your words and your actions will impact other people. Fifthly, David learned to trust in God's guidance. We get to chapter 23. Word got to David and his band of outlaws that the Philistines were attacking an Israelite border town. They told David, saying, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are plundering the threshing floors." So David did what we all should do. He inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" And the Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines, deliver Keilah." But David's men said to him, "Behold, we're afraid here in Judah. How much more if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines?" Then David inquired of the Lord once more. And the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, and I will give the Philistines into your hand." So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, and he led away their livestock and struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah. So David is brought this news. Keilah was a town, a border town, located on the border between Israel and the Philistine territory. Tough place, big defenses, but it was being sacked by Philistines. And you can almost hear the urgency in this news. David, we got to do something. They're attacking the threshing floors. You know what happens if they take the threshing floors? We all starve. But to his credit, David didn't give in to that pressure to act immediately. First, he went and consulted the Lord. Now, according from what we can tell, David was doing this through something called the ephod, which was a procedure spelled out in the law of Moses. The ephod was a special vest worn by the high priest. It had a pocket in it in which were kept two very special stones, the Urim and the Thummim. And the way this process would work according to the law of Moses, the priest would seek guidance from the Lord by asking him a yes and no question. He'd reach in and pull out one of those stones at random, and that would give him the answer. So David starts doing that to seek the Lord. He took advantage of the opportunities to also to consult recognized prophets like Gad, who he was introduced to when he took his parents to Moab. And Gad later shows up as part of David's court. So we know he had Gad on retainer, along with other prophets like Nathan, to give him good advice. Now today, you and I don't cast lots to determine what God wants us to do. That's just not the way we're instructed to do it. How do we seek guidance from the Lord? We seek guidance from God through prayer, seeking God through prayer, asking Him to allow His Holy Spirit to guide us. We also seek guidance through His Word and studying His Word and learning what God is like and trying to see what principles He's laid out for us to follow. We consult with mature spiritual leaders to get advice. It's wisdom and much counsel, Proverbs tells us. Whatever the situation, always take time to seek God's guidance. We get bad news and we're like, I got to do something. Stop. Go before the Lord. Say, God, what's the wise thing for me to do right now? You're never, ever too busy to seek God's guidance. If you're too busy to seek God's guidance, you're too busy. Some of y'all recognize the name Martin Luther. You know, the guy that kicked off the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. Martin Luther once famously replied, I have so much to do today, I must spend 3 hours in prayer to get ready. Now, most of us can't spend 3 hours in prayer, but we can spend a little time saying, God, what's my next step? Give me guidance. Give me wisdom. Always seek the Lord's guidance. 6, David learned compassion for others. In verse 5, we saw under the Lord's direction, David and his men drove off the Philistine raiders and saved the border town of Keilah. And then when news reaches Saul, Saul sees an opportunity to finally get rid of David. We was told Saul that David had come to Keilah. Saul said, God has delivered him into my hand. For he shut himself in by entering a city with double gates and bars. See, Keilah's strong defenses made it a great place to hide, but a horrible place to try to escape from. And so Saul says, I got him. He's right where I want him. Saul also intended to put pressure on Keilah's residents to betray David into his hands. After consulting with the Lord, David realized that the people of Keilah would give in to the pressure to turn him over to Saul rather than risk becoming another knob. David goes to the Lord, asks the Lord, hey, are these people going to rat me out? Are they going to turn me over to Saul? And the answer comes back, yes, David, they will. David could have stayed there. He could have said, this is a well-defended city. We got 600 fighting men here. We can hold out against this greater enemy until they give up and go away. But that's not what David did. Rather than risking the safety of the people of Keilah through an extended siege, David and his men decided to leave town so that they would be spared. Why? Because he saw what happened at Nob. He saw what happened when his words and his deceptions created a bill that had to be paid by other people. So he learned compassion. David also learned to conquer fear. Verse 15, David and his men are hiding out in the wilderness. And who should come to seek him out but Jonathan? Now, I made a mistake last week. I said when he fled from Saul, that was he and Jonathan's last time to be together. I'd forgotten about this episode. But Jonathan seeks him out. And it makes you wonder, all these people keep seeking David out. How come Saul couldn't ever find him? God must have been looking out for him or something, you know. But Saul, Jonathan comes to him, and look what he says in verse 17. Thus he said to him, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you." And Saul, my father, knows that also. Do not be afraid. Why do you think Jonathan, his best friend, is telling him, don't be afraid? I think maybe David is starting to get a little frazzled at this point. We know that David was feeling some anxiety because he wrote a song about it, as David often did. Psalm 54, and we know this song was written about this episode because he references something that happens in verse 19, where the residents of another town sell him out. But in Psalm 54, David pours out his fear and reaffirms his trust in God's power to deliver him. "Save me, O God, by your name. Vindicate me by your power. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers have arisen against me, and violent men have sought my life. They have not set God before them. Behold, God is my helper. The Lord is the sustainer of my soul. He will recompense the evil to my foes. Destroy them in your faithfulness. Willingly I will sacrifice to you. I will give thanks to your name, O Lord, for it is good. For he has delivered me from all trouble, and my eye has looked with satisfaction upon my enemies." When your path leads you down some scary valleys, choose faith over fear. Remember what the Apostle Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5, verse 6 and 7. "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you." We live in a time where people are eaten up with anxiety. Of course, I know nobody in here ever wrestles with anxiety, right? No, I didn't think so. Cast your anxiety where? On him. Why? Because he cares for you. See, part of our anxiety is we worry about whether or not God really loves us. No. You ever doubt God loves you? Just look at the cross. You can cast your anxiety in him because he has shown he loves you. He cares for you. Paul wrote in Philippians 4, 6, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God." You know, and I know it's easy to say when you're eaten up and worried about the situation you're dealing with, hey, don't worry. The old song, "Don't worry, be happy." I don't know about you, I found that doesn't quite work so easily. But you know what I have found does help? Start counting your blessings. Start thinking about all the things you got to be thankful for. All the ways God has shown up to help you in your life. And that ball of anxiety will begin to unwind some. Paul and Peter knew what they were talking about. When the storm comes over your life, let Jesus be the solid rock that you're anchored to. And then finally, David learned not to give up hope. Verses 19 through 29. To make a long story short, a group of people living in the wilderness where David was hiding sought to betray him to Saul, the Ziphites. Next thing we know, Saul and his troops are there, hot on David's heels. In verse 26, it looks for a moment like Saul has David trapped. Saul went up one side of the mountain, David and his men were on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. So, Saul's climbing up one side, David's on the other. At some point, apparently, Saul split his forces to send him around both sides, kind of a pincher movement, and he's got David right where he wants him. And it's beginning to look like curtains for our hero. And just as Saul is about to close the trap on David, look at verse 27. But a messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land." He is this close to catching David. And it's those Philistines again. Wonder who stirred them up. Saul breaks off pursuit of David in order to meet the Philistine threat. This battle is so famous that a local landmark was named after it. Verse 28, so Saul returned from pursuing David and went to meet the Philistines. Therefore, they called the place the Rock of Escape. Kind of like, hey, where do you want to meet? Oh, let's meet at the Rock of Escape. As David meditated on this close call, what do you think he did? He wrote a song about it. Psalm 63. Oh God, you are my God. I shall seek you earnestly. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh yearns for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. Thus I have seen you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. My lips will praise you. And then down verses 6 and 8 through that psalm. When I remember you on my bed, I meditated on you in the night watches, for you have been my help. And in the shadow of your wings, I sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. Whenever or whatever struggles you are facing in this life, remember this. Ain't over till it's over. Okay? Keep trusting in God. Keep looking for His intervention. And if God doesn't bring you out of it, I guarantee you He will bring you through it. I love the Rocky movies. Anybody else like the Rocky movies? You know, they all pretty much follow the same script. They just change the names, right? It's a formula. There's always a sequence in the middle of the Rocky movies where either Rocky or the person he's training is getting ready for the big fight, right? And some of you right now, you're hearing that music in your head. But we see the person, you know, the Rocky, you know, working out and struggling and sweating and running and getting stronger and faster and tougher in order to face the opponent. Because it's in those training sessions where the real fight is won. You know, life is not easy. Sometimes it seems like you barely finish one battle before the next wave arrives, right? You may even find yourself fighting several battles all at one time. Never forget, it is during those struggles that God is training you. He is teaching you and testing you. He is preparing to triumph through you. Keep the faith. Hang on to Him for dear life. Seek to learn the lessons He is trying to teach you. And when the fight is over, you will stand with Jesus on the victor's podium. Remember the words of James 1:12. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love Him. Hang on and keep trusting in Jesus.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.